Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs Committee, and
I kind of got that.
First off, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 563. Have to get used to that. Mm-hmm. Senator Beyer.
Sure.
Janet, can you give us a...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 563A should have... would require a water utility to mail notice of water bills that are delinquent for more than 120 days to the persons who are listed as owners of the property and tax records for the county. It applies to water utilities that are operated by public utilities, municipalities, cooperatives, and unincorporated associations. You should have at your place or from your packet the Senate staff measure summary by Judith Callen. The Senate vote was 23-1 with Senator Johnson opposed. And I believe this has to do with rental and other types of property where the water may be cut off and without the owner knowing about it or previous occupant. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer, State Senator, District 9. I bring you Senate Bill 563, which Ms. Atkins has done a very good job of describing what the bill does. The reason for this bill is a couple things. It was brought to my attention about a constituent who went and bought a house in a water district, and we went to move into the house, found the water district told him that he could have his water turned on as soon as he paid the back bill of $300 and some for water. So we introduced this bill that would not allow a water district to shut off the water or not turn it back on because of an unpaid water bill. We worked with the League of Oregon Cities to amend the bill to what you see today in the Angros version that would just require the municipality water district to send a notice to the landowner. In many cases, this happens because a tenant in a rental is not paying the water bill and the landowner doesn't know about it. We found out in our deliberations that in the model real estate agreement used by the realtors in the state of Oregon requires disclosure at time of sale as to whether or not a water bill has been paid. So we weren't as concerned about the issue of a sale transfer that way. It's more that in a landlord-tenant situation is what this bill is attempting to get at. We also found out that there is a Court of Appeals decision from 1973 that very clearly says it was the City of Portland versus someone, Multnomah County, anyway, that water districts or water utilities are not allowed to shut off water because of an unpaid water bill to a previous tenant. So this is an issue that the water districts, by and large, have agreed to support because they think it will help them also keep their water bills current and notify everyone who has an issue or dealing with the utility when a bill is not being paid. So it'll be an opportunity for them to keep more current on their billings and for landowners to know if their tenants are paying the bills or not, which is a good indication whether or not rent is going to be being paid also very soon. So that is the A. and Gross bill that I'd like to speak to. There is an amendment to the bill being offered by Representative Richardson. I'll let him discuss that issue with you at his leisure. The amendment is not mine. The bill has the right relating to clause, Representative Richardson's issue, and I told him he's welcome to talk about that issue in front of you, but I'm not going to speak to that amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Have answered any questions.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions? Don't say any. Thank you very
much. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Allow me to testify.
Okay, can I have Representative Richardson, please? Did you have some people you wanted to bring with you?
I would if I could. If
certainly,
could,
please.
Cliff Beebe and Trent Nitzler.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, representatives of the committee. We're here to speak in favor of an amendment to SB 563 that the senator has just referred to. And I have with me two residents from my district Trent Nisler and Flip Beebe, and with leave of the panel and the chair, I would like to go ahead and have them just speak. Explain what's going on.
I ask you to identify yourself for the record and go right ahead then.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, my name is Trent Nisler. I live at 2992 Lapine Avenue in Central Point, and I serve on the Water District Board that's referred to in this amendment. We're having an ongoing problem in this subdivision, a rural subdivision, with water and the lack of over time as a result of a number of outside things that are referred to in this letter, I believe, that you were given. We've been working with the Medford Water Commission to see if they can help us to obtain water, public water, for our usage. Because of the way their charter is set up, they've been unable to help us. We've met with them on a number of occasions, and in April, we met with them again, and they expressed interest in our plight, but said that what they suggest that we do is to get as creative as we could to give them an opportunity to help. They suggest that possibly we try to get annexed into a local city, local city's urban growth boundaries. We've examined those options. That doesn't seem possible. And they said, well, do the best you can to get creative to give us a reason to say yes. And this amendment would give them the wherewithal legally to help us to get water in this area. That's the gist of what we're trying to do.
Thank you. Yes, you, sir?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. My name is Cliff Beebe. I'm also a resident of Central Point, Western Subdivision Water District. I concur with what Trent says, of course. We have been working on this project for approximately 6 years. We have worked with the Army Corps. We have a municipal piece of municipal water supply in Lost Creek Lake. We have permits to bring the water down the river. We have estimated our infrastructure. What is missing is a viable means to get the water that we need from the river to our subdivision, approximately 10 miles. And we've been, like Trent said, we've been working with Metro Water Commission for years, trying to find any option possible to satisfy this issue. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So the Medford Water Commission, is that for the city of Medford? Is that who they supply and who they represent?
Okay, yes. The Medford Water Commission supplies, was intended to, set up to supply the residents of Medford, but they have branched out and they supply water to all cities and other municipalities in the Rogue Valley.
And why is it they can't supply water then to this Westwood Subdivision Water District?
They have a charter, rules and charter that say that they can't supply water outside the urban growth boundaries
of either Medford or the other cities that they currently supply to.
And Representative?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Medford provides the resource or the way, the infrastructure to transfer water from Lost Creek Reservoir, which is a large reservoir up in the hills, down to the Rogue Valley. They supply water also to Central Point, and then from Central Point it also goes out of Central Point's urban growth boundary to Erickson Air Crane. But they have indicated that, and I think that Representative Escobar could probably give more information on this, that since the 50s they have had restrictions from granting water to outside of the urban growth boundary. But what's really, really significant is that Westwood, this group of 63 residents, they have set up their own water district. They've made arrangements with the Corps of Engineers up in Lost Creek to have water, so they're not asking for any of Medford's water. They've got that arranged. What they have to have is a way to get it to them. They're willing to assume all the costs. They'll pay Medford Water Commission for the right to use their pipes, and Medford's Water Commission is not used to its maximum now anyway, so it's no negative consequence to Medford Water Commission. And this, as you'll see in the handout, there have been several things that have occurred in recent years that have diminished the availability of water. For instance, there's a U.S. Forestry nursery that's downslope and they've installed drain pipe 5 feet below the grade. Harry and David Orchard has an upslope replacement. There's been changes in the practices of agriculture around, and it's diminished the amount of water that's in this. These are very shallow wells, between 40 and 50 feet. And so what's really happening is, as the water is diminishing, the concentration of pesticides from agricultural use are becoming more concentrated. And so there are houses, you know, in this area that can't get enough water, or the water's been found to be unpotable because of the concentration. And so these families have gotten together, set up their own water district, arranged to buy water from the source, and would like to pay Medford Water Commission for the use of the pipe to get it to them. And the Water Commission told them in April that, you know, if you can come up with a way, that's fine, but our charter says that we can't do it. And so they said their hands are tied, but they opened the door saying, you know, if you can come up with a legal way for us to do it, we're willing to do it. And so that's the most recent thing that's come up.
And they can't just amend their charter. That can't be done.
Mr. Chair, it may be able to be done. There's politics in Medford that are cutting against that, but we're hoping that we can look beyond those politics.
Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, I think that this needs to be addressed right here and now. You have tried for a number of years now to do this, even though that you know you don't qualify, even though that when you bought these houses, you knew they were a low-producing well area, and you knew that they had some problems with their wells. Now, you've been working on this for several years, and you've been working the system to try to get the city of Medford to give you water. And what really tipped the scales on this is when we went to West Side School, when the city of Medford provided that to the Naval Reserve, which is a government entity, which they're quite capable of doing within their charter amendment. Now, having said that, you knew when you first started and bought in there the problems with the water. Everyone does. That's been going on since the 70s. It's been going on about 35 years. The policy of the city of Medford has been this way since the 50s. And why did they do that? I'll tell you why. Because it's going to open Pandora's box. What will happen is people will start building subdivisions out in the county, and then they're going to say, City of Medford, you need to provide me water. And if they say no, they'll say, well, guess what? You provided Niedermeyer. That's exactly what this is about, is a precedence of policy. If you want to go back to the local level and get people to change their policy and amend their charter, you shouldn't be up here trying to get us to change their policy and their charter. Why don't you take it to the voters in the city of Medford? And by the way, Medford sells only to municipalities. They do not sell to districts other than what was prior to their policy change back in the 50s. So I suggest you go back there, work with the city of Medford. If you think it's worthwhile, then you need to get the city of Medford to change its charter and its policy, not come here to do it.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. I live in a really high growth area, Happy Valley, North Clackamas County there, and water is always an issue. And I still sit on the Sunrise Water Authority Budget Committee. As a matter of fact, we just passed our budget along to the full commission last Tuesday night, I think it was. And we have, I don't know how many thousand customers. I think we have 35,000 customers in our district. And in 20 years, we're projected to have 135,000. And we don't have the water rights to provide that. And I appreciate you bringing this forward, because it's one little example of a lot of the problems that are facing us in water. And I'll tell you, you guys know better as well as I do, water is going to make land use look like a cakewalk in this state. I've said it before, and I'm saying it right now again. My question to you is, did you all in Westwood secure, do you have any water rights, and are they completely used up, and are you seeking to perfect a water right, or can you just give me a little background on that? And just to be fair, I share the good representative's concern about doing local policy here in this building. There were a statewide policy and we were amending and changing, which I'm very interested in looking at, Representative. I would be more comfortable with that. But do you have water rights in this district, and are you working on perfecting more water rights in Westwood, not Medford?
Cliff Beebe again. We do not have water rights other than our groundwater wells. Mm-hmm. We have, like we mentioned before, secured the option to buy water from the municipal reserve at Lost Creek Lake, which is a very large supply. Mm-hmm. That was our intent, to just meet our needs on water. And the reason we have shallow wells is because there is unpotable water deeper. So, you know, the first response people ask, why don't you just deepen your wells? That's the reason.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
No.
I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, to respond to Representative Esquivel's comments, this water situation is a situation that is presently worsening. When the people who bought into that subdivision all the well flows, short a few, were fine to take care of their needs. But there have been things happening since we bought into that subdivision that is lessening the water that's there. Specifically, this piping, there are open ditches that are used for local irrigation that are being hard piped. Mm-hmm. And so this is a situation that isn't fixed. It's still moving in the wrong direction. I think the important thing here is that we have been in contact recently with Medford Water Commission, and their present stance is they want to help us. And I'm not sure that's what Representative Esquivel understands. They said to us specifically in their last meeting, we understand your plight, we would like to help, we think we have the ability to help, but you need to find a way to help us make that decision legally. And they specifically said, why don't you see if you can get annexed into a local city? Why don't you get it annexed into some local city's urban growth boundaries? The flavor in Medford Water Commission was not in opposition to us. It was simply, given the way that we're structured right now, we need some help. And this, we feel, would give them the wherewithal to do that. It's very specific to this one situation. We're the only water district that's been created in the Rogue Valley in the last 30 years. It isn't like anybody can just step up and create a water district. They can't build a tract and then go ask for water. It isn't possible. So some of the things that we're concerned about here aren't really real. The reality is we have a 35-year-old tract that's very unique in its proximity to the water that we have, that it's unique in the sense that we have this ongoing problem, and this could fix it.
Representative Gilman.
Yes. This issue goes further than, and my father used to live in the Niederbayer subdivision. I fixed his well a couple of times, come to think of it. The issue, I think you understand, and we have we just passed a law in this body on this side of the chamber that would require a double majority to annex a piece of land into the city. Here's my concern. You get city water, and ultimately the city of Jacksonville or the city of Medford finally gets out to Niedermeyer subdivision. It's a ways away, but it's probably going to happen. Those residents of Niedermeyer subdivision will have water and sewer. They have no reason to join the city. So we have another enclave has all the services it needs, so it won't annex into the city. I have some problems with this. I understand your plight, and I wrote myself a note. I will be making some phone calls to Medford Water Commission and check to make sure where they stand on this. It's too bad you couldn't have brought someone along.
Is there any other questions? Go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chair, may I respond to Mr. Representative Gilman? Are you Les Gilman's son?
Say what?
Sir, are you Les Gilman's son?
That's correct.
Yes, he was one of our favorite residents there for a long time. Nice to meet you. Also, to the issue, we are told by everyone that we talk to that their Medford urban growth boundary, Jacksonville Central Point, will never come to include us because there's EFU surrounding us completely. If the EFU is changed to some other designation, then there's a possibility. But all the state studies that we've monitored over the years show that we will never be included in an urban growth boundary, which leads us to this kind of an opportunity. seeking this kind of opportunity, because we're going to be high and dry for a long time. Thank you.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do I understand that your potable water is getting worse, and that you're basically losing your water due to pesticides or something in the water, in the groundwater? Is that what you indicated?
Mr. Chair, yes. That, and really, even our larger concern than that is just the availability of water in of itself. What water we have is very questionable, doesn't test well, but even that water is disappearing.
Follow up. I know in some of these communities and developments, there's oftentimes they put in a little community reservoir to hold water and actually truck water. Have you looked into that possibility?
Mr. Chair, may I respond to that?
Sure.
Yes, sir. I'll give you an example of my situation, which is not atypical to the residents. I've lived in this subdivision for over 10 years. First 4 or 5 years, I didn't need to supplement my water. I have a 2,000-gallon tank. Since that time, I bought a water tank. I truck water in increasing quantities every year. Second issue, the quality of the water. We do water tests, and I would say, and this is just somewhat of a guess, but nearly half the residents in our subdivision have some kind of treatment system on their groundwater. They either have UV or chemicals, chlorine, chlorinators, all those kinds of systems on their groundwater system. And the reason is we can't go deeper than 40 feet and we get all the decay from organic material plus the orchard pesticides that go down to that level, and they can't get away because there's a clay layer. And this has all been substantiated by the Oregon geologist, hydrogeologist, by the way. And so we're stuck with that level of water. We're stuck with what gets down to that level. And that's all we have.
Mr. Chair, one more.
Representative Shockworth.
Thank you. And you talked about the irrigation ditch being piped off, I imagine, in the name of conservation efficiency. And some of your wells are drying up due to that. And this has happened all over the state, by the way. But that's one of the reasons, as well as the contamination of the water.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions?
May I respond to that just sure. A little more detail? There was an orchard behind us that was owned by Harry and David, and they ran in addition to the main irrigation ditch that runs along the hillsides behind us, they supplemented their orchard supply with an open ditch that ran directly behind our subdivision. In the recent years, about the time all of us needed to start hauling water, they piped that open ditch, which is everybody in the state's wanting to do that now to conserve water for all the right reasons. That was a big impact to us when they did that. And there's been a lot of talk about enclosing all the irrigation systems around the Brogue Valley, and that is going to be a big problem to everyone. I'm sure you're aware of that.
It's going to be a big problem.
Thank you.
Thank you. I sat on the water committee chaired by Representative Jensen, and his favorite saying is that whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony this morning. Long trip up here for that. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 5563 and open a public hearing on House Bill 929, Senate Bill 929. Janet?
929?
Yeah, I think that's the one, isn't it?
The blue book.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 929 was sponsored by the Committee on Judiciary in the Senate at the request of Magna Entertainment Corporation and Multnomah Greyhound Park. Would allow wagering on simulcast racing even if a live race meet is not occurring in the state. This bill original bill was precipitated by the closure of the Greyhound racing. Current law provides that a live race meet must be running in order for simulcast wagering to take place. The bill provides an exception that a horse race licensee may conduct simulcast wagering on Greyhounds if there is no live race Greyhound racing operator, and it also supplies the converse that a Greyhound race operator may only offer simulcast on horse racing if there is no live horse racing operator. Mr. Chair, you'll hear a little bit of the history of the reason for the bill from the proponents. There's also a change in the purse account percentages that are given to thoroughbred, quarter horse, and other racing associations. And the number of race day meets, 720. I'm not sure if there's much of a policy change because the 80 races in a 7 month, 80 races a month in 7 months comes out to 720 race meets anyway, so they can talk about the policy if there's a policy change there. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you do have a fiscal impact statement from the Senate side, the Senate staff measure summary, and the floor vote is attached in your packet. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet. And this amendment I have in there is from the Senate side. Okay. Thank you. Could I have Dave Nelson, Larry Campbell, please? Morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Larry Campbell, Representative Magna Entertainment. House Bill or Senate Bill 929 is supported by the dog industry and the horse industry alike. One of the efforts here really is to save the horse racing industry as well then as the horse industry itself in the state of Oregon. It makes a contribution annually of something over $150 million and provides some 3,000 jobs. One of the things that's extremely important to us is not only do we need to save the racetrack because it has such an influence on horse racing, but this will also help us save the racing at county fair meets. The other thing that's extremely important to us is the fact that we need to improve the purses for our horse racing folks, both thoroughbred and quarter horse across the state, if we're going to keep them viable. This is one of the steps that's important to us to help solve this financial problem. The financial problem is emphasized when you look at Magna's financial report since 2001. They've invested $21 million in the state of Oregon. They've taken care of an EPA problem, which cost them almost $1 million, which stopped racing a few years ago because of runoff into the Columbia River Slough. In addition to that, they've had a $7 million operating loss, and this is the thing that concerns us the most. One of the things that's extremely important is that they've done a number of things to try to cut their operating loss, and one of the areas that concerns us, but we were unable to handle it, is the fact that we ended up having to determine the stopping of one type of race in the state of Oregon, either horses or dogs. The dog racing was selected as the loser, and the Greyhound track was closed. Basically, the future for horse racing is almost as dim if we are unable to find ways of helping financially improve the situation. Present law requires that you have to have live racing in order to receive simulcasting revenue. It was perfect for Magna, who bought the rights both to Greyhound racing and horse racing when each of them was running six-month sessions, because there was live racing all the time. So the simulcasting during the horse races went to the horse side. Simulcasting during the dog racing times went to the dog side. Of course, both of them then went to Magna. At that point in time, Magna was losing a substantial amount of money, but would have lost a great deal more if we hadn't had that simulcasting. Now that the dog track is closed and we do not have any live racing, it's by law and important to recognize that we cannot receive those funds. Now, the Oregon Racing Commission has extended for 1 month our ability to do that. That's why we're so pleased that you've given us some preference today in moving this bill, if you are kind enough to move it, because we have got to get the bill moved in order for the Racing Commission to continue to allow the dollars to go to the horse side. I could spend a lot of time. I gave you a full package of the financials of Magna, and I think you'll find that of interest. But the real key is this is our opportunity to save horse racing for the state of Oregon. There's one question that one of you raised in our meetings with regarding the extension or increase in gambling as a result of this. The truth of the matter is that there is no increase in gambling. The horse folks may run less days because the law that Janet spoke to, 720, can be reduced by agreement between the track and the horsemen, and that's really the change in that bill. If dogs were to run again in the state of Oregon, our estimate would be that they would run no more than they have it in the past, because the Racing Commission would have to approve any live racing by dogs, and though that undoubtedly would be the case if a new racetrack was established, we're sure that they would continue the practice of not having dogs and horses run against one another. So we have a substantial number of folks in the audience who have expertise in all phases of this problem and this particular solution, and would be more than happy to respond to any questions that you might have. I would like to make an announcement that Dave and I are celebrating, because in the horse racing business, if you own a horse, it's very easy to lose a lot of money. And last night, our horse won at Los Alamitos, and we broke even this month.
Horse racing, kind of like logging, that if you win the lottery and win $10 million, you can do it for 10 more years?
Chairman, you kind of tread water, representing us well, hoping to hit a home run one time.
Dave, you have some testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dave Nelson, representing Magna Entertainment and a longtime raiser of racing quarter horses. I'm here basically to answer any technical questions about the bill that any of you may have. We don't want to get in the way of an affirmative vote by any means, but we would hope that the committee would see a fit to take prompt action on the bill, as Larry described, and you might want to ask the chairman of the Oregon Racing Commission, Mr. Steve Walters, is in the audience, the importance of the bill and prompt action on it.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Representative Shoffler.
And the bill, as we have it on our agenda, that's what we're seeking to...
Mr. Chairman and Representative Shoffler, yes, it's extremely important to us that there be no amendment made in this bill. The agreements relative to dogs and horses was decided by the Senate, and we have no problem with the way the bill came to you, but it's extremely important that it move forward.
Thank you. And then I understand, and I just heard this from a constituent this morning, Oregon's the only state in the country with a no kill policy for greyhounds. They have to be adopted out, and the people bring their dogs here.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shoffler, this is a very interesting process. They have an adoption process with the greyhounds in Oregon. I've been trying to get my kids to adopt them for my grandkids, but I will share with you that it is a first-class operation.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Jen, you have a...
I just had a question about the purpose or the effect, I guess, of the percentage change in the purse percentages to the associations.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think, Janet, you're talking about subsection, page 2, lines 14 through 22. Basically, horsemen now receive 1% of the wagering handle, the total gross wagering handle, for specific purposes, to pay bonuses back to breeders of Oregon-bred horses, and that's to encourage the breeding industry. So it's 1% of that amount of money over a 6.5-month period. When you extend that out to a 12-month period, the horsemen agreed to take 0.75%. They'll get more money over the course of the year, but it'll less, slightly smaller percentage.
Okay. Any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you. Could I have Steve Walters and Jody Hansen, please?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the commission, or of the committee. I'm on the commission. I'm Steve Walters. I'm chair of the Oregon Racing Commission, and with me is Jody Hansen, the executive director of the Oregon Racing Commission. We are here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 929. As you have heard, Senate Bill 929 is vital to the survival of horse racing in the state of Oregon, and to the survival of the horse farms, of the jobs of the people who breed and raise and care for and race horses in the state of Oregon. I've been on the Racing Commission since 1991. I've been its chair since 1994. And during that time, I've seen racing in Oregon literally engulfed by the expansion of other forms of gambling in the state of Oregon. The increase in the lottery, the increase in Native American casinos. And unlike those forms of wagering, which have an ability to expand and modify the sorts of games that they offer, and are doing so yet, as we know, with the authorization for slot machines as a lottery game. Racing is limited to one product, racing, and racing also is subject to statutes that contain a number of artificial limitations on the ability of the race meet operator to generate revenue. And frankly, in today's environment, to survive. The core purpose of Senate Bill 929 is to eliminate one of those artificial limitations, which is that you have to be authorized to run a live race meet, which is uneconomic to do on a year-round basis, in order to obtain simulcasting revenue. Given the economic situation in Oregon the effect that it's had on racing, as I've said, that is vital to the survival of horse racing in Oregon and the jobs that it creates. I have heard the concerns about expansion of gambling, that this bill will allow for the expansion of gambling in Oregon. I simply would make two observations. First, as my remarks have indicated, my experience and my perspective is that racing is a victim of the expansion of gambling in Oregon. It is not contributed to it at all. Racing contributes a small fraction of the amount of money that is wagered by residents of Oregon, both on the lottery and at casinos, as well as illegally on the internet for these offshore casinos that are available. Secondly, I would point out and echo what Dave Nelson said, that if this bill passes, there will be less wagering on racing in Oregon still than there was last year or the year before or the year before that. This is a bill that is vital to the surviving of racing, and we urge the committee to move it along as promptly as possible with a due pass recommendation, and I would be glad to entertain any questions you might have.
Thank you, Steve. Any questions? Don't see any. Okay, Representative Holden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. I was just noticing that, you know, speaking of that this will produce some revenue for the state if this bill goes forward in the terms of that tax, and it says that the revenue is deposited in the general fund in excess of expenditures. How much expenditures are? I mean, I didn't see anything in here about there's no fiscal impact to passing this bill as far as in the expenditure column?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, I think the fiscal impact indicates that if there is the reason for the assessment is if there is no Greyhound racing, and if this bill does not pass, there will be no revenue to the state of Oregon generated from simulcasting, because there will be no simulcasting. So in that sense, this bill is a revenue enhancer, because without it, there will be no additional revenue. In terms of the expenditures, because of the closure of the Greyhound meet, the Racing Commission has had to lay off employees because of the loss of the revenue from the Greyhound meet.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Jody, do you have some testimony?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jody Hansen, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Racing Commission, and I echo Chair Walter's statements. This bill is vital to the continuation of horse racing, and as far as the Oregon Racing Commission is concerned, as a regulatory body, racing has been part of Oregon's history since 1933. The Oregon Racing Commission currently has approximately 7,000 licensees that are affiliated with racing in Oregon. And not only does would the abolishment basically of racing in without the passage of this bill in Oregon affect all of those directly that race, but it would also affect all of the agricultural businesses and so forth that are go along with this. And I know down in the Medford area with the Grants Pass race meet that's going to be starting, the agricultural companies down there and the feed stores and so forth derive 50% of their income from that short summer fair race meet that happens mid-May through July 4th. And what else was I going to tell you? Oregon also is a premier and a forerunner with their regulations that we have in other states. Look to us for guidance and collaboration on that respect. So it would be very much of a travesty if this bill did not move forward. Thank you. I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Thank you, Jody. Any questions? Don't see any.
Thank you
for your testimony this morning. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on Senate Bill 929? I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 929 and open a work session on Senate Bill 929. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 929A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves Senate Bill 929A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, call the roll, please.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries. Need a carrier. Representative Kitts will carry it on the floor for us. And with that, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3319. Janet, can you...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3319 was heard on April 19th.
This is the horse.
There were two issues discussed. One was a double penalty for potential double penalty that industries saw in the statute that they weren't so concerned about Boley assessing a double penalty, but the court system obtaining a double penalty. And there was also a time card issue for employers that use time cards and the prompt payment after termination of an employee. And those issues are now contained in the Dash 2 amendments. And Lisa Tressel from AOI and Annette Talbot are from Boley are here to discuss the amendments. The time card issue is the bottom of page 1 on the Dash 2 amendments and also on page 3 of the Dash 2 amendments. And the double penalty issue is kind of buried. It's a little bit difficult to find. Is on page 4 of the Dash 2 amendments, lines 19 through 23. So maybe I'll wait for everybody to get it out.
I can't find my Dash 2.
I've got an extra one if you need it.
Oh, there it is.
I don't know where it's at.
I'm okay.
George had it all the time.
You got to watch, George.
Go ahead.
So, again, the bottom page 1, lines 21, is the time card issue. And the employer is given the ability to estimate the dues, the wages that are doable, payable, and then within 5 days after the employee submits the actual time record, then the unpaid wages will be payable. So it allows, again, the employer to estimate in case of the time cards, and the same change is made on page 3, that a penalty would not be assessed if they went through that process. And then on page 4, lines 19 to 23 are the changes related to the penalties. So again, there. And this was Paul Cosgrove's issue, and he's also here.
Thank you, Janet. Lisa, Paul, and Annette, please. Which one?
I think I've been elected, Mr. Okay. Chairman. Paul Cosgrove, representing Addis Healthcare. We talked to you during the last work session about what we hope to accomplish and have accomplished in these Dash 2 amendments. These are amendments that resolve the issues that you heard about in the public hearing and do so in a way that's acceptable to all the parties here at the table. I'd be happy to answer any questions, but Ms. Atkins did a good job, I think, of describing the various issues and where they're related in the amendment.
Representative Shoffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we're all content and ready to move forward, right?
Yes.
Yes, sir.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Any other questions? Don't see any. Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3319.
Representative Kitts moves the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3319. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, they're adopted.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kitts.
I move House Bill 3319 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 3319 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, call the roll, please.
Representative
Gilman.
Aye.
Representative
Colby.
Aye.
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Representative
Shoffler.
Aye.
Representative
Gilman. Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. Carrier?
I'll take one if you want me to.
Okay. Representative Gilman. Open the work session on House Bill 3256. Janet, please.
Mr. Chair? Thank you. This bill was brought to you by Associated Oregon Industries and has to do with whistleblowing statutes, and you should have the Dash 1 amendments, and we have representatives of Foley again and Lisa from Associated Oregon Industries. There is a new definition of whistleblowing that applies to the civil proceedings that constitute whistleblowing, and it's my understanding that this takes care of the concerns of Associated Oregon Industries when they brought the original bill, and so they're here to explain or answer questions.
Lisa? Annette? I guess I could have just asked you from a distance, but... I'll let you explain what we have here, the amendments.
Well, okay. Annette will have to probably chime in. But on the Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell with AOI, and we're here to ask for your support in adoption of the Dash 1 amendments. And our issue dealt with lawsuits in general that weren't directed towards an employer. And Bully's concern was that, well, it could have been a future employer or a former employer or something, and there was a concern about that our bill as originally proposed was too limiting. And what they came back, and we had long discussions, several discussions, was that if the civil proceeding that an individual files against a business who happens to be an employer deals with a whistleblowing activity, then they would still be protected. But if it's just a general suit that has nothing to do with whistleblowing, that protection wouldn't apply. And
perhaps you want Ms. Talbot to explain, just to make sure I got that right.
Mr. Chair, Annette Talbot, Deputy Labor Commissioner, for the record. Yes, I believe Lisa has done a good job explaining it. Our goal is to protect the person who comes forward to do something that may deal with themselves directly, but has the aspect of whistleblowing. In other words, something's doing something against the law. And a civil proceeding is both in court and an administrative proceeding. So now this part of the reference to someone using the civil proceeding process, we want to encourage them to, but I think that the statute is directed to wanting to encourage them to do that specifically. It's about something like whistleblowing, something that the public and potentially themselves as well gets a benefit from. So it will now include threatening a complaint against someone related to whistleblowing or contacting an agency or actually objecting to do something if they think that it's against the law. And those things would be protected activities if they involve filing a proceeding or testifying in a proceeding. So I think it's a good change to the law to update it to reflect that concern. As we've seen from many high-profile cases, whistleblowing can provide a lot of benefits to the public when things come out that are being done that we need to know about.
Thank you. Any questions? Don't see any.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments into 3256.
Representative Kitts moves the dash two?
One.
Dash one amendments to House Bill 3256. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, they're adopted. Representative Kitts.
I move House Bill 3256 as amended to the floor with your due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 3256 to the floor as amended with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, call the roll, please.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Representative Hoffman.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative
Vessel. Aye.
Representative
Gilman. Aye.
Chair
Brown. Aye. Motion carries. Representative Shields will carry on the floor. Thank you. Open a public hearing on House Bill, or Senate Bill 398. I'm going to get that down here.
Problems with the Senate Bill.
Yeah. 4 months and the other. Well, this is... okay. He's not coming. Okay. Janet, tell us what the bill does, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 398 is sponsored by Senator Westland, and he was unable to come today. It would modify the definition of foreign limited liability company to include an entity organized under laws of any federally recognized Indian tribe. The issue relates to the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs, and there's a representative here to discuss the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Michael Mason, please. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Chair Brown, members of the Business, Consumer, and Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs Committee. I want to thank you for scheduling this hearing so promptly on Senate Bill 398. This is an important bill for a few people, but a few people who are engaged in entrepreneurial activity on the Warm Springs Reservation. The bill corrects an oversight in the limited liability corporation statute that was passed a dozen years ago. At the time, people weren't thinking about tribes chartering limited liability corporations. Since then, the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs has chartered four of these. To date, they have only operated on reservation. They have some business opportunities now near the reservation, but the tribe's attorneys have advised that they not operate off the reservation because they probably would not have the limited liability protection of the state statute. So they are now totally conducting their business on reservation, eagerly awaiting passage of this bill so that they can be treated like a corporation, an LLC coming in from the state of Washington or from a foreign country under Oregon law. Now, I'd be happy to answer any questions about this housekeeping bill that will help support tribal members' business ventures.
Thank you, Michael. Representative Kitts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Michael, does this have any application? I realize that this is a fix for one specific tribe right now, but does this have application to all tribes in Oregon?
It could ultimately. We don't know of any other tribe that has an LLC ordinance like Warm Springs does. And I think the fundamental point with this is unless you have enough business on reservation to justify this, you're not going to see this kind of tribally chartered LLC. They're going to have to go out and just get chartered under state law like everybody else. So.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you very much.
Is there anyone else to testify on Senate Bill 398? And then we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 398 and open a work session on Senate Bill 398. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 398 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves Senate Bill 398 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Kate, will you call the roll, please?
Representative
Kitts.
Aye.
Representative
Chalkler.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Esposito.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move Senate Bill 398 be placed on the consent calendar.
Representative Kitts moves that Senate Bill 398 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Seeing none, it's on the consent calendar. Open a... so we go to the next one then, 259. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 259. We're supposed to call Senator Walker to go wait until she. So we're on 259, Janet.
Why trader vote no one both?
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 259 was brought to you by the Oregon Association of Association Management.
Freshman.
Everyone's interrupting you.
So I'll throw that down here. Let me show you how it works.
The bill would permit boards of directors of nonprofit corporations to conduct business by electronic means. Currently, they cannot use technology to conduct official business. Some of them may be doing it without knowing that it's not allowed, and this bill would make it easier for people to meet and do business as boards of corporations, nonprofit corporations. And I'll check where Bill Cross is.
Yes, find Bill Cross. I will have Andrew Morrow, please.
He's having to wait for Bill Cross. It's a busy man.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The reason Mr. Cross is out in the hallway is because I'm here.
Okay.
We had some questions with respect to the bill. My name is Andrew Morrow. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland. I serve as legislative chair of the business law section of the Oregon State Bar. I'm not here today to take a position on behalf of the bar because we haven't really considered this bill at that level, but I wanted to bring to the committee some concerns about the bill from myself and also talking with the attorney who chaired the task force that really drafted the Nonprofit Corporation Act in 1989. The existing language in ORS 65337 is exactly the same as what's in the Oregon Business Corporation Act. And the discussion Mr. Cross and I were having earlier was to what extent these kinds of electronic meetings are permitted under the Business Corporation Act. And basically, the approach that we have often taken with respect to those two acts is to try to keep them in parallel. From my perspective, this makes a change and raises some questions about the mechanics of holding meetings. And I've identified some of those in the written testimony, but basically the concern about the ability to communicate effectively and how do you interact an electronic meeting with directors who want to be in a face-to-face meeting, which generally is what we recommend to our clients, because you have a lot of nuances from tone of voice, and if you can be face-to-face, from body language that you don't get from typing on the computer screen. That's, in a nutshell, I'll keep it short, but that's the area of concern. It's a step that I think technologically will come forward, but we're not sure it's an appropriate step at this point. And if the committee wishes to go ahead with this, one suggestion that we would make to the bill, which is on down in my testimony, just requires that there be some communication to directors so that they know how to participate in one of these meetings if they actually occur. Section 2 of the bill deals with the specific issue of action without a meeting, provides a way to do that electronically. We're making a suggestion to do this in a different way, which would address not only this particular section, but also the other sections of the Nonprofit Corporation Act, and in that sense, again, keep the two statutes in parallel. That allows lawyers and others to look to the Business Corporation Act, which has a lot of legislative history comments and such to it, to determine how to approach these things. I'll stop at that and answer any questions and let Mr. Cross.
Did you testify on the Senate side, Mr. Morrow?
No, I did not. This bill actually didn't come to my attention until it already passed the Senate. And we have it on our agenda to discuss at the Executive Committee, but have not. So my position here is to give the committee information and not trying to really take a position on behalf of any organization other than myself.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Schonkler.
Thank you. You know, we are definitely going this direction, whether people like it or not, whether it's the right thing or not. And personally, I have no problem with this bill. I guess my question is, because the reason I have no problem is Oregon's huge. Now, we got folks living clear out where Senate Representative Butler lives, clear over here. And everybody, I want more people participating in these things. And I'm sure you do, sir. I'm not suggesting anything. My question to you, if there is some legal problem here, in your experience, because I don't take what you're saying lightly, how soon do you think it would be before we saw any wrongdoing? I'm asking you to speculate now, just for my own curiosity.
Chair Brown, Representative Schauffler. I'm not sure that this is an issue so much of wrongdoing. It's a question of how do you include people? I mean, the statute right now provides for telephone conferences. You can combine very easily a face-to-face meeting with a speakerphone, and that's really the methodology that people use. For example, our executive committee, our chair is in Pendleton. He usually doesn't come. The face-to-face meeting is in Portland. He's on the phone from Pendleton. We have participants on the phone from Eugene and Medford. And through that, we have interaction that I think is a lot more effective than just looking at a computer screen, instant messaging, email. I mean, I use that all the time, but I don't think it's the most effective way to conduct a meeting. So that's the reason of my hesitation with it. My other concern is how do you combine that process with people who would rather be on the phone or in person. It's very easy to combine people in person with telephone conference call or even video conferencing. Combining it with online is harder. I think the technology certainly will come there. I guess I'm just concerned about whether it's at that point.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you, sir, for your testimony.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 259 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 207. And Janet, can you give us a rundown on the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 207 was in pre-session filed at the request of Attorney General Hardy Myers for the Department of Justice. It would require insurance companies to receive a return receipt when they cancel or terminate certain types of insurance by electronic record. And if they do not receive the return receipt from the consumer, the policy may only be canceled or terminated after providing delivery of the notice in writing to the consumer. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You have the information. It's a non-fiscal and passed the Senate floor 27.
Thank you, Janet. Can I have Senator Walker, please? And Kevin, too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. I'm Vicki Walker, State Senator in District 7. It's nice to see all of you.
Senator Walker, I think we haven't been in a hearing room together, I don't think, since Commerce Days in room 50 downstairs.
Oh, Mr. Chair, those are haunting memories.
Well, and that's, no offense to the chair, I'm sure.
Well, he was not chair at the time, but we have haunted memories because we spent many hours in that room with no windows, and the hearing never lasted 2 hours. It went ad nauseum. So, Mr. Chair, we have something that we will share forever on that. Thank you. I'm here today on Senate Bill 207, and I asked the department to introduce this bill at my request. They're a good department. They respond immediately. And let me tell you why I had this bill introduced. In the 2001 legislative session in which I participated, we passed a bill that focused on the Uniform Electronic Transaction Act. So let me talk about that. Congress passed the Uniform Electronic Transaction Act in 1999, and Oregon adopted it as it was presented in 2001 without any changes. Other states also followed suit. The problem with the Uniform Electronic Transaction Act is not only did it make it easy for people to communicate with their insurance companies by electronic media, but it exempted two types of insurance from being canceled by electronic media. So in the instance of health insurance and life insurance, you cannot be canceled by electronic medium. You must receive something in the mail. Congress thought that was pretty important, that you not have those items canceled through email. But gosh, Mr. Chair, I think the other two types of insurance are just as important, and I'll tell you a story why. And the other two types of insurance are property and casualty insurance. So that would be your home, and that would be your car. And let me tell you how this bill came about for me. I was in a traffic accident, I guess it's been well over a year now, in Las Vegas. I was in a vehicle driven by my daughter's boyfriend, and my daughter was in the front seat, I was in the back. Someone attempted to run us off the road because they were not paying attention. We spun out of control, ended up going across four lanes of Las Vegas traffic coming at us vertically as we were going horizontally, and they were traveling at least 70 miles an hour, and we survived. I don't know how, Mr. Chair. Some tractor beam was on our car, and we survived. We got to the other side and hit the concrete abutment and totaled his vehicle. I was injured. My daughter was injured, not seriously, but injured enough that I needed medical care when I returned home, and my daughter received some medical care. at the scene of the accident, the police officer came and asked to see his insurance, and he looked through all of his papers, and he had all of his insurance stuff, but nothing seemed to be updated and current. And so we said we would take a look at that when we got back to the apartment. We were pretty shook up, and I showed the officer my ID card, and he was happy to let us go and communicate with him later. Well, the next day, we found out that this young man did not have insurance anymore. It had been canceled on him unknowingly. He had agreed to transact business with his insurance company by electronic email. They sent him notice upon renewal, and he didn't get it. They sent it a couple of times, but he didn't get it, and they canceled. And he didn't know it. So now, Mr. Chair, he has a totaled vehicle. He has an outstanding loan on his totaled vehicle of $15,000 at a local bank. And he has two injured people who need medical assistance. So under the law, I was able to, and my daughter was able to, go under my own vehicle insurance to get coverage. So my insurance carrier had to pick up the tab for my medical care and my settlement. That isn't the way it should be. And this young man now is quite in debt. So we, with this bill, will not allow insurance companies to do that anymore. They're going to have to do a very simple thing. A very simple thing. If you agree to transact business by electronic mail, then you must, when you get the notice, the insurance company will attach a return receipt request. It's very easy to do. You can do it on your own email, and then when you open it, it will send back a notice to the insurance company that you received it. If you do not receive that, the insurance company then has to send you notice by regular old-fashioned postal mail. Mr. Chair, we have a high number of uninsured people in this state, and then people who do not want to be uninsured and find themselves in that situation really get caught by a system that they didn't expect to. And I would say on March 13th of this year, the Register Guard ran a story by the Associated Press called Fight Against Spam May KO Wanted Email. And I'd just like to read you one quote. In fact, there is a lawsuit in Los Angeles Superior Court alleging that some people feel that their ISP is not giving them the kind of service in delivering their email. These emails get caught in spam filters, or we don't know what happens to them. But this one man who is a security consultant in Wyoming says users should simply get used to losing email. Even though people are relying more and more on email, email was never designed as a guaranteed delivery medium. And service providers are only required to make a best effort, a term left open to wide interpretation. So, Mr. Chair, on matters of this import, I do not believe we should leave this open to wide interpretation, and that's why I asked the department to step in, and I'll let Mr. Neely speak now.
Thank you.
He has written testimony.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Neely, on behalf of the Oregon Department of Justice and Attorney General Hardy Myers. As Senator Walker indicated, she did bring this bill to us during the interim. We looked closely at the bill, thought it was a very good idea for, in fact, all of the reasons she described. I'm going to be very, very brief since I do believe Senator Walker covered the main details of this bill. I would only add that, again, we believe that this is a fundamental and important consumer protection. It keeps uninsured drivers off the road, which I think is a goal that we can all agree is laudable, and it helps those folks who may be in jeopardy of having their insurance terminated understand what the consequences are, understand how they might be able to rectify that situation, and hopefully give them notice that if they choose not to rectify that situation, they ought to stay off the roads and out of their cars. We have in no way tried to limit the scope of UEDA, the Uniform Electronic Transactions Act. In fact, that's a very good act. It does streamline the process. But again, as Senator Walker said, when it's time to have your policy terminated, it seems to the Department of Justice that on behalf of consumers, better to double check and to ensure that you have taken every step to notify the consumer that, in fact, they're at the end of the road. It's time to either figure out what's going on with your policy or to understand that in fact, you shouldn't be in your vehicle. So with that, again, I think this is a very good bill. I appreciate the Senator bringing this to our attention. We have worked with the insurance commissioner on this. They have I don't believe they have any position on this bill, but again, I think this is very good consumer protection. Hopefully you guys will get this bill to pass and send it to the floor.
Representative Schaffer.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. Mr. Neely, this is a good idea. I agree with it completely. We're talking about the advances of technology in the last bill. I heard on the radio just this morning, I wanted to share this, about a community down by the Gulf of Mexico or somewhere that they asked the people that lived in the community, how would you want to be notified for in case of a hurricane? And a bunch of thousands of folks checked off email. Well, when they sent the warnings out, the spam filters filtered all of them, because one of the way they filter is if it's by number. If a bunch go out, they filter it. So I guess there's a lot of glitches and bugs to get out of this technology, but I thought that was interesting. Thank you, Senator. I hope the young man learned a good lesson from all that, too.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Schaffler, he actually did. He now he cohabitates with my daughter, and she will never let that happen. And they do not transact business by email anymore, because I've told them the danger involved in that. And, yes, he certainly has learned. And, you know, it's interesting, Mr. Chair, I was talking to my daughter on the way up here this morning to tell her this bill was up in the House, and she said that her own boss got caught in the same situation. He got stopped for speeding, and it's an automatic for a police officer to ask to see your insurance. And his insurance had expired, and he didn't know it because he transacted business by email. Fortunately, he's not in an auto accident, but he got a hefty fine. And now it's also important to remember, Mr. Chair, this doesn't just apply to auto insurance. This is home insurance. So if your home burns down and you've been canceled by email, you're in a world of hurt, because there's no way that you're going to be able to replace all your belongings or that home without filing bankruptcy and never really surviving that. So, Mr. Chair, I just really think this is a good bill. And I plan on taking it state by state, let me tell you.
Any other questions? Representative Kitts.
With the state by state comment, does that mean you're now running for president?
I thought you were. Are you stumping, Senator?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Kitts, Congress didn't quite get it right with this one, and Congress, the wheels move very slowly, so I figure it's easier to go through NCSL and the Council of State Governments West to get this done, and no, I'm not running for president. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you very much for your testimony this morning. No other questions? Don't see any. I think we're done.
Yeah. Good bill.
Is there anyone else here to testify on Senate Bill 207? Don't see any. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 207 and open a work session on Senate Bill 207. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move Senate Bill 207 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves Senate Bill 207 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, call the roll, please.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carried. Representative Kitts.
Fine.
You got it carried on the floor? Consent calendar?
I think so. It's a simple bill. It's a good bill. It passed. Consent calendar.
Okay. Representative Kitts moves Senate Bill 207 be placed on the consent calendar. Any objection? Seeing none, it's done. I want to reopen a public hearing on Senate Bill 259 and Bill Cross, please.
Welcome to Business and Labor Bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Derek Kitts, thank you so much. It's been a while. My name for the record again is Bill Cross. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Society of Association Management, which introduced Senate Bill 259 to permit boards of nonprofit organizations in Oregon to conduct business through electronic means. And in the past, board meetings could be conducted over time. The statutes were changed to allow them to be conducted by teleconference. rather than in person. And so a number of organizations, particularly in Oregon, will do that if they're statewide in nature because of the geographic nature of the state, to allow members from around the state to participate. In many cases, rather than having physical meetings, they will conduct a teleconference call. However, if you're not available at the time of the teleconference call, you're unable to participate. Electronic means would allow the board, if they so choose, and if their bylaws are changed to permit this, to actually allow all board members to participate through the electronic through electronic means. The proposal was based on the state of Wisconsin, which has already approved this legislation. We understand other states are in the process of it. I mistakenly may have referenced Oregon corporate law incorrectly. We had an attorney who advised us that private organizations, for-profit organizations, could already conduct business by electronic means, but the attorney who testified before me has indicated otherwise, and I don't work enough in for-profit law to be able to really suggest other than what he's already commented on. However, be that as it may, we believe the legislation would be an important step for Oregon to take. Many of our organizations have members who are very electronically driven. Many of our organizations do a number of other events, such as education, training, annual business meetings, where we're conducting sessions that are provided to our members through electronic means. People cannot physically attend a lot of these meetings. Our committees can take action through electronic means. But from a corporate, an organizational standpoint, our board of directors currently cannot do that. I've looked at the amendments being offered. I just got them this morning, so I haven't really had a chance to review them with the Oregon Society of Association Management. I don't believe they're necessary. I believe that when a corporation changes its bylaws, it will need to address whether or not it's going to allow this, and then what form or fashion they're going to permit electronic voting and how the information will be conveyed to the participants. So I don't necessarily see those amendments as necessary to this bill. I would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Billy, from what little I know about non-corporate or corporate law generally, is that the principle is that when a board is making the decisions, you should be able to hear the dissenting views of other members. Could you help paint a picture of how this might, that principle might be entertained electronically?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, if you conducted a board meeting via electronic means, the group would be on a group address, and you would send out, I as executive director would send out the information, what the issues were, and what actions the board was being asked to take, and then members could respond if they needed more questions, more information, or if they wanted to discuss the issue. They would participate in that by responding to the entire group.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
So in like a listserv fashion, is that what you're talking about?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, that's correct. And you would allow, for example, you could allow by your bylaws, a 12-hour, a 24-hour, whatever period of time you would allow them to participate and have that discussion out there before you're going to require a firm vote on whatever the issue is. For example, one of the organizations I have as an association management contract, they require their payables to be approved by the board of directors on a monthly basis. Well, they don't meet physically monthly, and typically what I'll do is electronically send a list of the payables, an explanation of what the purpose was for the payables, the amount, etc., and then I actually have to set up a telephone conference call to try and get at least a quorum together to actually vote on the payables, approval of the payables. Now that's this would allow them to obviously do that by electronic means. I would probably, you know, send that out with a 24 or 48-hour period. If they had any questions, it would go back through the group to me, and I could respond and hopefully clarify any issues. You know, for more complex issues, I think clearly most board of directors would be, I mean, are probably going to look at those as issues you address at regular meetings or teleconference meetings if the issues are complex because of the nature of, there again, that communication dialogue.
Any other questions?
Mr. Representative, comment. You know, I do share the lawyer's concerns. Forgive me for forgetting the names here. But I do believe this is a direction that we're going in. And these groups aren't, I just think we should facilitate their ability to have everybody involved. And I also comment, you know, 50 years ago, somebody would have said, we shouldn't have any meetings by phone. And now we're doing them every day. So I really, let's just do it and move on and let them meet over online. And if there's things come up, we'll find out. If not, we won't. So just wanted to give that editorial comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you for indulging me.
Thank you. Any other questions?
I'm convinced.
You're convinced. Representative Shields.
Bill, did you mean they're conceptual amendments or are there actually amendments printed?
No, there aren't.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, I believe there are some proposed amendments that Mr. Morrow...
But there are no amendments.
No, yeah, I'm sorry. Yes, the conceptual amendments.
Okay. Yeah, and, Mr. Morrow, in his written testimony, had made two suggestions on the backside there. Any other questions? I don't see any. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you very much.
And with that, close the public hearing on Senate Bill 259. Thank you. Okay. I'm going to open the work session on Senate Bill 259. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move Senate Bill 259 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves Senate Bill 259 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, will you call the roll?
No.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Representative
Trump.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries.
I'll carry it, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Representative Shaw.
I got my speech ready.
Okay. Be ready for some questions.
We just heard it, didn't
we? If anybody has any questions, they could just email it.
Representative Shoffler will carry the bill on the floor for us.
Or email it for the floor.
Janet, do we have anything else? Which one is that?
No. Oops. I'm sorry. Not that one.
Oh, and that one? No, not today.
Good.
With that, we're adjourned.
You know, Ramona, we're in Iowa.